from KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump railed this week against the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's guidelines for schools to reopen in the fall. Trump has made it clear that in order to maximize his chances of re-election in November, American society and the economy must return to normal in spite of a massive resurgence of the coronavirus. On Wednesday, just hours after Trump denounced the CDC school guidelines on Twitter, Vice President Mike Pence claimed, "Well, the president said today, we just don't want the guidance to be too tough. That's the reason why next week the CDC is going to be issuing a new set of tools." CDC Director Robert Redfield said a day later that the guidance would not be weakened. Meanwhile, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, who's emerged as one of Trump's strongest allies, also insisted that schools must reopen. The proponent of so-called school choice insisted against giving educators and parents a choice on whether kids should go back to school. My guest is Kevin Kumashiro, former dean of the School of Education at the University of San Francisco, leading expert on educational policy, school reform, teacher preparation, and educational equity and social justice. He also happens to be our education correspondent. Welcome back, Kevin.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me, Sonali.
So there is not necessarily a clear-cut sense on whether schools should reopen or not. There's a debate happening in this country. There are pediatricians who feel that it's worth the risks. Then there's the Trump administration that seems to think there is no choice, that schools must reopen. But it's difficult to trust the Trump administration on any of these matters, right? Because they've made it very clear that they're driven by politics rather than science.
Yeah, given the range of, given how different communities are from one to another in terms of rates of infection, as well as given the difference in terms of the readiness and resources of schools to be able to open safely, it seems very problematic that we would issue this one-size-fits-all solution about what everyone must do. And I think it does, as you're pointing out, it does kind of raise questions about the politics behind this call. You know, just like with so many other issues, the push to reopen, I think, is driven so much by wanting everything to look not just normal, not just back to normal, but raising questions of, well, did we really need to close schools at all in the first place, right? And I think all of that helps to deflect attention from the really dismal failures of this current administration to address the pandemic when it had a chance early on, and to better address it now when it still has a chance but is refusing to do so.
I want to play for you and our audience some excerpts of Trump officials, starting with the president himself, followed by Vice President Mike Pence, CDC Director Robert Redfield, and Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, all of whom speaking this week on the importance of reopening schools. This seems to be their new issue.
We're safely reopening our country, and very importantly, we're safely reopening our schools. We want the schools to be open.
It's time. It's time for us to get our kids back to school. The president said today we just don't want the guidance to be too tough.
But I want to make it very clear that what is not the intent of CDC's guidelines is to be used as a rationale to keep schools closed.
Ultimately, it's not a matter of if schools should reopen. It's simply a matter of how. They must fully open, and they must be fully operational. And how that happens is best left to education and community leaders.
Betsy DeVos saying that how schools should reopen is left to education and community leaders, except that, of course, there's the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issuing their guidelines as well. It seems as though the White House officials can't even agree upon who should be issuing the guidelines by which schools should reopen. So, Kevin, first of all, what was it that the CDC released? The CDC used to be this world-class institution that Americans could boast of. Under the Trump administration, has really lost so much credibility. So it's hard to take anything that it says seriously, but it did release guidelines on school reopenings, right?
It did. And it's actually not even as sort of stringent or tough as Trump and his colleagues want to suggest. You know, what the CDC suggested is what many cities are right now trying to do just in general. And it's sort of saying, let's really think about how we implement those kinds of guidelines, safety guidelines in schools. So it was around kind of staggering the returns to school so that we're not, especially in really crowded schools, we're not packing people in where social distancing is impossible. It's about spreading chairs, spacing them out more. It's about cleanliness. It's about face coverings when practical. So I feel like it shouldn't sound like a surprise in terms of what they were suggesting. But as you might imagine, especially in more overcrowded schools, less resourced schools, there's an enormous investment that needs to be made to prepare the schools to open in this way. And I think that's where we're seeing the financial kind of angle coming in, right? Whether you keep schools mostly closed and rely on technology, or you reopen schools, but reopen them in ways that allow people to be safe and less likely to contract the illness. Either way, you're gonna have to spend a lot of money to get schools ready for the fall. And I think that's where we're seeing the sort of threats around reopening, ties to school funding. It sort of is a reminder that this all sort of does boil down to money.
So it's also quite ironic to see Betsy DeVos suggesting that it's not a matter of whether schools are going to reopen, it's a matter of how they're going to reopen. This is a proponent of school choice. You know, figures like her and figures on the right, people who have encouraged the anti-lockdown protests, the mask refusers, love to point out how American liberty is first and foremost more important than anything else, more important than even public health. But somehow, when it comes to the schools, there's no choice involved now.
And school choice is going to be a really interesting, I think, policy issue to track in the next few weeks and months, particularly around federal stimulus funding. So, and the reason I bring this up is because, you know, Trump's recent comments is around tying federal funding to reopening, right? Like you threatening to withhold federal funding if schools don't open. And so this is an interesting and complicated issue at the same time. So the federal government contributes about 10% of school district funding or school funding, right? The remaining 90% comes from states and locals. And this is tied in with legislation through Congress. So many have said, well, Trump can't follow through unilaterally on withholding federal funding since this is actually a congressional act. But actually where Trump does have a lot more leeway and where we expect strings to be tied to federal funding is with the stimulus funding, is with the stimulus packages. And that's both the third package, the CARES Act that we saw in March that had over $13 billion for education, but also in the fourth stimulus package, which is much larger, right? If the Senate Republicans get their way, it might be tens of billions, but if the House Democrats get their way, it might be over $100 billion. And there are others who are pointing out that you might need more like over $200 billion to get schools ready over the next 1 or 2 years. So where we can see kind of the forcing of opening is with the leveraging of those funds. And then more recently, I think there's speculation that, well, here is another way to leverage federal funding to push the kinds of free market principles that folks like Betsy DeVos has been pushing. So we, in other words, we may see not only strings tied to federal stimulus funding to schools reopening, but we also may see it tied to expanding school choice.
And the backdrop of all of this is what you were just alluding to, which is that public school districts are extremely worried about budgets once the pandemic started already. Of course, education budgets were always stretched to their limit. After the pandemic started, because the economy began collapsing, how did that impact the bottom lines of schools? We've heard of a lot of school districts start to already suggest that come fall, there would have to be or might have to be layoffs unless there was the kind of stimulus funding that Congress came through with.
Absolutely. I mean, even just from April labor data, we saw that about 400,000 public school employees were losing their jobs. And that can only be escalating if the federal government doesn't step in. And so I think tied In, however, with the reduction in revenue, particularly at state and local levels, and why we need federal funding, right? If they're providing 90% of the funding and their revenues are going down, we're seeing states slash across the country budgets for not just education, but all kinds of public services. But in addition to that, what we saw is that this was a moment for profiteering. In other words, what funding there is available is going more and more towards the private sector. And this should sound familiar because actually there was writings by folks like Naomi Klein, who talks about how post-Katrina 2005, before the floodwaters even receded from the city of New Orleans, it was the Republican Study Committee, right, the conservative caucus in Congress that was strategizing how to put forward what they called free market, pro-free market reforms to respond to Katrina. And included in that package of reforms was privatizing the school district. And so you saw within a few months, the first federal voucher program for New Orleans. You also saw most schools reopen as charter schools, right? So this was a way to kind of fuel privatization. And that's exactly what we saw in the midst of all the stimulus funding being put forward from the federal government for the coronavirus. We saw people pushing for vouchers in different states, including Betsy DeVos at the federal level with her so-called micro grants. We also saw, however, hundreds of millions of dollars being siphoned off by the charter schools. And that's just within the realm of what Betsy DeVos was doing, because we also know that in different states, tens of millions of dollars was being siphoned off from what should have gone to small businesses going to charter schools.
Right.
So this is absolutely a moment when privatization is sort of being, it's like opportunistic, right? This is the moment to take advantage of a crisis in order to fuel that agenda.
Going back to the issue of school reopenings this fall, President Trump tried to compare the United States to a number of European nations, saying that, you know, there are countries like in Sweden and Germany where schools had no problem reopening, and those countries had no problem reopening their schools, except, of course, those are countries where COVID-19 infection rates have been brought under pretty incredible control. I mean, in all of the cases that he cited, Germany, Denmark, Norway, and Sweden, there are only, you know, a few hundred cases now of infection that are being tracked. There's been a very strict tracking, testing, you know, and that sort of central government policy that you might expect a Western industrialized wealthy nation to adopt. They've adopted. They've brought their pandemic under control, and so they're opening schools. But Trump doesn't seem to notice that there's a huge disconnect between those countries and the U.S., which is now leading by far in the number of infections worldwide, I mean, even when adjusted for population.
And those comparison countries, I think, are such interesting comparisons, because you have like three types of countries that he's naming, right? You have Norway and Denmark, for example, which before you even saw infections take off, they were clamping down, they were sort of requiring, you know, the kinds of social measures that we know can help to slow the spread of the virus, plus public health measures like testing and contact tracing. You saw Germany, where there was early explosion, but then they clamped down and were able to kind of control. And so, yes, in those countries, things are looking much better. You can actually open schools without as much fear. Sweden is a third type of example, though, that tried to do the sort of herd immunity kind of thing, right? They didn't shut down. Things got really, really bad, and they never really shut down. So then there really is nothing to kind of reopen. But what's interesting about the Sweden example, as we know, is not only was the infection rates so much higher than their Scandinavian partners like Denmark and Norway, but we also know that the rationale was you keep everything open, you keep the public sectors open so that the economy can keep going. And the evidence is that you have all this infection, all this deaths, and the economy actually didn't look any sort of better than their partners that clamped down. So economy is still struggling. And on top of that, you have a massive amount of kind of infections and death. So three interesting comparison countries none of which sort of gives us an indication that what Trump wants to do in the United States is actually the right thing to be doing.
Yeah, and thank you for pointing out the Sweden case. I'd forgotten because Sweden has generally been more progressive on other social issues. But when it came to the pandemic, it had chosen a very different path. So if the United States had adopted, say, a Germany-like policy or New Zealand or any of these countries that have done, that have basically been in charge and done the right thing and followed the advice of scientists, it would be a very different conversation today about reopening schools, right? It seems as though initially Trump gave in to scientists because he didn't, maybe he was caught off guard. And we saw advice from people like Dr. Anthony Fauci. And then pretty soon he realized, wait a minute, my re-election is the most important thing. And now we are adopting the Sweden model, it seems, and everything is survival of the fittest. It's sort of that's the mode that it feels that we're in. Cases all over the country are skyrocketing. Per capita, Arizona and Florida are worse than whole countries. So it seems as though their school policy is going to be equally haphazard, right? I mean, how can we trust that they have any scientific backing to what they're saying?
And I think that's where superintendents, that's where state boards are really struggling, is that because the federal government is offering no sort of trustworthy leadership and guidance on this. Everyone's sort of trying to figure things out for themselves. And I think, as you're pointing out, the issues are so complicated. It isn't possible to give, even with the best of science, a one-size-fits-all solution. Why? Not only because the contexts vary from community to community in terms of infection rates, in terms of resources of schools, but also because the issues at stake are so complicated. Like, think about, for example, we know that the longer students are away from schools, there are all kinds of compounding issues, right? Their academics are going to be impacted, their academic development, but so are their mental and emotional health. And so are sort of all these other issues that get sort of exacerbated, inequity issues and injustice issues get exacerbated. And that's why I think some of the interesting models to look at are countries that try to respond to the coronavirus crisis by looking at equity issues. One of many examples that come to mind would be a place like Morocco, where one of the things that they did immediately was through the public sector create technologies that give curriculum, right? They created through the public sector lesson plans online. They used the television stations for people who didn't have laptops. They had this whole tablet, television stations for people who don't have internet access. They had a tablet initiative to get the hardware into rural areas. And I'm not saying everything that they did was perfect, but one of the things that I think is interesting about that is that they really focused in on what the public sector needed to do, not to rush to reopen schools, but to forefront what are the equity and justice issues. Where are we seeing inequities? And you tackle that first. And I think that's really the strategy that the United States needs to be looking at. Not how do we get back to some vision of normalcy when normalcy wasn't even all that great to begin with, but rather to say, what are the inequity and injustice issues that are being exacerbated by the pandemic, and how do we zero in on those issues first?
I'm wondering what we also need to be thinking about when it comes to the mental health of educators. I mean, yes, of course, there's the kids, and then there's educators who already have high-stress jobs, who already routinely spend money out of their own pockets for educational resources and materials that they know the kids in their classroom need, but they don't have access to, who might be wondering, how am I going to be spacing desks 6 feet apart in classrooms that are barely big enough to hold kids as is pre-pandemic? And, how am I going to be able to afford the extra protective gear that the kids in my classroom who might come from poorer communities will be needing, et cetera, et cetera? And what if I catch the coronavirus as I'm constantly exposed to children who are living, dozens and dozens of children a day who are living in family environments that can't be controlled because we have a disorganized, chaotic approach to this crisis? I cannot imagine what teachers are thinking during their summer break right now.
I'm so appreciating highlighting the extra burden that teachers are bearing and going to have to bear, particularly when we have so little guidance and so little resources. And I think you're pointing out so many of them, right? It's not only we have extra financial burden on teachers who we know are going to step up, so many of them already do by pulling out of their own resources to cover some of these expenses. Teachers are having to work extra time to come up with new ways of addressing kind of standards and needs of children. We also know that teachers are going to have to bear some of the emotional burden as students are struggling with trauma, with all sorts of stresses, additional stresses at home, as well as all the compounded problems we know might be happening with the students' struggle that teachers are not going to have to be dealing with. And then, of course, there's their own physical health, which is one of the really big concerns, right? A lot of people are like, well, young children, they're not as likely to get ill, or if they do get ill, they're not as likely to get severely ill. But the reality is that some of the people we actually do know are very likely to get very, very ill are the aging teacher population, or adults in general, but aging in particular. So all of these issues, where are teachers being, how are we thinking about the livelihood, the wellness, the safety of teachers? I think that is as important as, I mean, they are part of schools. We need to be thinking about everyone who's in schools, particularly those who are most vulnerable.
There's also, of course, the choice that parents are facing. We, of course, have laws about education for kids, which makes sense. You have to educate your kids either by sending them to a public school or a private school or homeschooling them. There are parents who might be essential workers for whom homeschooling is not an option, or parents like me who can't imagine homeschooling my kids because that's just not my thing. Also, I work full time and I'm an essential worker. And so parents themselves are also in this incredibly difficult situation. If there are people who have elderly parents at home, and if there's a child who has to go to school, coming home after being exposed to a bunch of other kids, they might be endangering elderly members of the family. And I just keep going back to the fact that the basic approach to dealing with this coronavirus crisis that we have not even considered, but that other countries have done, which is that the government ought to be paying workers to stay at home, paying them directly so they don't have to worry about money, and so they can be at home with their kids till a vaccine is found, till we can bring this under control, till we can reopen our economies in a controlled way. And no one's talking about that, but those are all important discussions that form the backdrop for anything like reopening our educational system, right?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I'm so appreciating those insights. I mean, we're so, as a country, we seem so hell-bent. We seem so desperately trying to cling to this very kind of the current capitalist model, and anything that even hints of socialism, we're just gonna be like, no, we can't go that direction. But absolutely, thinking about guaranteed income so that everyone can be well, thinking about even labor, like thinking about how in the spring, as we shuttered schools and we moved towards online education, we weren't actually relying on online education. What we were actually doing was relying on parents to become somehow the proto-teacher, you know, to sort of substitute themselves for the teachers. And what was the result? Well, actually, many parents don't know how to teach in quite the ways that are needed in schools. They're not trained teachers. And so one of the things I think we need to think about is how we, how do we want to think about what schools should look like? How do we build ourselves in that direction? And how do we build the capacity of all the different sectors, parents, teachers, children, caregivers, everyone, to be able to support that movement towards that vision? I think we're so invested in returning to what we thought was the status quo before, and we thought as if that was really good. And what we have to tell ourselves is actually the status quo wasn't all that great to begin with. So this is an opportunity not to retrench, but to actually re-envision and to build our capacity to move in that direction.
Well, Kevin, always appreciate having you on and getting your insights on these matters. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Kevin Kumashiro. He's the former dean of the School of Education at the University of San Francisco. He's a leading expert on educational policy and school reforms, teacher preparation, and educational equity, as well as social justice. And he is the education correspondent for Rising Up. We've been discussing Trump's mandate for schools to reopen in the fall. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.